The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week, I talked about delusion. And at the end of that discussion, at some point I said, well, this was leading into the discussion of not self, and I said, well, this is too big to talk about now, so I thought I'd talk about it tonight. So I'm going to talk about not self tonight, this understanding of not self. And in looking at what I had to, or was thinking about talking about, I realized that this is a lot, even here, for one night. So I divided it up into two. So I'll talk about what I'd like to talk about tonight is kind of the understanding of the teaching, as best as I can discuss it and present it. And then next week, talk about how we can explore that teaching through observing and understanding what we think of as self. So this week I'll talk about not self, and next week I'll talk about exploring the selfing process. And I'm hoping that by dividing it into two like that, that it leaves time for discussion, because I think this is a topic that's really helpful to allow discussion with. So I'm open to questions. So I just want to recap a little bit from last week to set the framework. So last week in talking about delusion, I talked about delusion from three perspectives. One being the sense of, you know, delusion, we can think of delusion as being not connecting to our experience, kind of spacing out, not knowing, just that kind of vague fuzziness. So that's one aspect of delusion. A second aspect of delusion is that we can live our lives, see our experience through views, through kind of filters, that opinions, beliefs color how we experience the world. And actually, in ways, kind of orient us to seeing certain things and not seeing other things because of our perspectives, because of our beliefs, because of our views. And the third way that delusion is understood is through a kind of a fundamental, through the deepest, let's say the deepest misunderstandings of our experience. So to put this one into context, one of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, says delusion doesn't mask our experience. And that's often we think about delusion as being something that keeps us from seeing things or experiencing things. But this kind of delusion, this third most basic, most fundamental kind of delusion, doesn't mask our experience. It doesn't hide our experience. He said it hides the true nature of our experience. So what is this true nature that he's referring to? The true nature of our experience is looking at our experience from kind of what's common, what's common about our experience, no matter what the experience is. This is an understanding that all experience, I mean, all experience has its own unique properties. You know, when sights have certain properties, sounds have certain properties, you know, that contact with our bodies has certain properties, and we can know the kind of unique experiences of each moment. But the kind of more fundamental qualities of experience is what they share in common. And what they share in common is that everything that we experience is impermanent. Everything that we experience, because of that impermanence, is unreliable in terms of being a place where we could be happy. That having that thing, we think having something will make us happy. Well, the very impermanent nature of it makes it unreliable as a place for happiness. And then the third characteristic of all experience is that there is no abiding thing or entity here, this not-self characteristic. Now, all three of these, the characteristic of impermanence, the characteristic of unreliability, the characteristic of not self, they refer to the nature of our experience. So nothing in our experience is permanent. Nothing in our experience is reliable as a place where we could say, yep, that thing, that experience, that will be the thing that will make me happy forever. And there's nothing in our experience that we can say is I or me or mine. So everything that we know of the world comes through our experience. So this is what the Buddha was interested in understanding, was the nature of our experience, not the nature of what's out there. That wasn't what he was so interested in. He was interested in understanding the nature of our experience and how our relationship to that experience impacts whether we are struggling or happy. So this third aspect, this aspect of not self, another way to put these three, impermanent unreliability and coreless or unsubstantial, essentially this not self characteristic of experience refers to the fact that there's not a thing there. It's more of a process. Whatever is happening is just a flow, a change of kind of an unfolding process. So I'd like to explore this tonight, hopefully in ways that will illuminate it a little bit. And I'd like to start from one of the teachings of the Buddha. He gave his second discourse on this topic of not-self. So in this second discourse, he related these three characteristics in terms of each other. So to start with, the very first thing he said in this sutta was not so much about the relationship of things to each other, but just one of the kind of fundamental characteristics of experience, that it's out of control. So these are some of his words. So he explored this, actually I have to give a little bit of context here first. He explored this teaching of not self in particular through a lens of what are the processes of our experience. So as I said, he's focused on experience here. And so how do we take in experience? And he talked about there being five basic processes by which we take in experience. There's the process of the body, you know, the contact of sight, sound, smells, taste, touch with our body. That's one way that we take in information. That's one way of exploring experience. And then there are some mental processes that he talked about. There's a process of feeling, that whatever we come into contact with through our body, through our mind, there's a quality of it being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's another kind of way that we take in information. A third way that we take in information is through recognizing what has been presented to us based on history, based on experience. So that, I look around this room and I see chairs, wall, man, woman, carpet. So I know these things because of this recognition process. So this is another way that we take in information. This is a process that relates to concepts, relates to ideas. Then there's a third process of knowing, just consciousness itself. It's the meeting, kind of the bare meeting of experience. So in terms of these processes, the process of the body, we take in the information, kind of just the taking in information, then the mental side, we've got feeling and perception and consciousness, and these things are kind of how we receive experience. And then there's another process that's how we act on experience. And this is the process of, it's called the volitional formation. So it's how we respond through intention, through attention, through acting. So it's the mental process of intention that responds. So all of these, this is a teaching called the five aggregates. It's five ways of breaking up our experience. They could be broken up in different ways. These were the understanding that some Buddhist scholars have is that these five ways of breaking up our experience were common in India at the time. It was kind of a way that they understood experience through these five perspectives: body, feeling, perception, knowing, and volitional formations, or kind of intending process of the mind. We could break it up in a different way. I mean, we might in Western psychology break up our experience in a different way. So there's nothing like, sacred about this. It's just a way of breaking up experience. Every aspect of our experience fits into these five categories. There's nothing that we experience that can't be found somewhere in these five categories. So this was a way of kind of looking at our experience, looking at the entirety of our experience. So he took each of these five areas, and with this group of monks he was talking to, he was asking them to explore each of these five areas with some questions, with some reflections. And so he says, form or body is not self. For if form were self, this form would not lead to affliction, and it would be possible to have it a form. Let my form be thus. Let my form not be thus. But because form is not self, form leads to affliction, and it is not possible to have it a form. Let my form be thus. Let my form not be thus. So this speaks to the nature of the lack of control. You know, that our bodies change, and we don't have control over that. So this kind of notion of what do we think of as self? This is pointing to the way we sometimes tie the sense of self as being the one who has some kind of control, some kind of agency over something. And the Buddha's pointing out, so we don't have agency over our body. So, wouldn't it be nice? Let my form be thus. We'd all be beautiful. We'd all have perfect bodies. But it's not that way. And he goes through each of these other areas. Same with feeling. It's not possible to say, let my feeling be thus. Let my perception be thus. Let my intentions be thus. That one's kind of interesting. That the intention is kind of a place where we feel like we have some traction sometimes. I can choose what I want to do. But when we really start looking, we see that, sometimes we don't have any choice. I mean, especially when we're not mindful, we see that, our habits of mind make our choices for us. And we don't have a lot of say in, may my choice be thus. This thing happens, we get angry. If we could, we would say, this thing's happened, may I not become angry. We don't often have that say. We don't often have that ability. So that choice, that choosing, we don't have complete control over. Nor consciousness. So I'm going to read this one just to kind of close the loop. Consciousness is not self. For if consciousness were self, this consciousness would not lead to affliction, and it would be possible to have it of consciousness. Let my consciousness be thus. Let my consciousness not be thus. But because consciousness is not self, consciousness leads to affliction, and it is not possible to have it of consciousness. Let my consciousness be thus. Let my consciousness not be thus. So this really speaks to the out-of-control nature of all of our experience. There are ways and times we feel like we get some traction and can have some control. You know, we go to the gym, we, you know, feel like, okay, you know, yep, we put certain things into our bodies. We don't put other things into our bodies. Like, okay, I'm going to control this body. And then, you know, at my time of life, I don't have a lot of control over my body, you know. I'll have hot flashes at various times, and my metabolism is completely out of whack, and it seems like, you know, my body's doing stuff I don't have any control over, any choice in the matter about. So this notion of control is one of the key pieces that we tend to attribute to what we think of as self. So that's part of what we're looking at here, is what is it that we think of as self? And this sutta begins to look at certain things, certain ways that we tend to attribute self, and begins to kind of pull the pieces apart. The next sections relate the three characteristics together. It starts by saying, okay, you know, form, body, is that permanent or impermanent? Body is impermanent. Feelings, perception. And when we look at all of these areas of our experience, there's an impermanent quality to them. There's a changing nature to all of our experience, no matter which aspect we look at. Because it's impermanent, it's unreliable. That we can't count on it. We can't count on our bodies, we can't count on our intentions, we can't count on anything as being a place, a lasting place to be happy. It's like, okay, I will construct my intentions, my feelings, perceptions to be just the way I like them. And maybe we can do that once in a while. We can create our experience to be just what we'd like. But how long does that last? It doesn't last very long because things are impermanent. Experience is impermanent. It's always changing. Because it's always changing, it's unreliable. And this is where the Buddha points to, again, how this is tied to this sense of not self. Because, well, at least at the time of the Buddha, and I think if we look at what we think of as self, what is it that we kind of hold to be self, that there's some notion that what self is some kind of a stable thing. If you think about it for yourself, I mean, it's not very clear what we mean by self when we start actually reflecting on it. You know, we have some notions about it, some notions about, okay, yeah, I, this is what it feels like to be me. It's more of a feeling in a way. And there can be kind of some kind of sense of stability of that, that we have similar kinds of feelings over time. But when we start to really look at those feelings, they're just so vague and so shifty that we can't really pin it down. So we have some notion of there being something stable in there, but we can't point to it. This very fact that we can't point to it is information for us. Something Joseph Goldstein says is the not finding of this is the finding. I'll come back to that. So I'd like to explore this understanding of not-self through some analogies. The Buddha often taught in analogies, and he didn't particularly use these analogies that I'm going to talk about now, but I think analogies are helpful to us. So these analogies are going to explore how our experience is process rather than a thing. This is, I think, the key shift around this teaching of of not self is that what we think of as self is a construct in our minds. It's kind of a concept in our minds. And what we think of as self, it's just not, it doesn't exist in the way that we think of it existing. There is something here. I mean, there's some process here, an Andrea process, that's different than the processes of each of you out there. It's not like, you know, they're going to get confused. But there isn't a thing here called Andrea. There's a process of Andrea. There's an ever-changing flux of experience. This is another aspect of this. But there's nothing that we can pin down in that stream and say, that's me. That's who I am. So we can explore this a little bit through the sense of a river analogy. I pointed to this a little bit in the guided meditation, just the sense of a river of experience, a flow of experience. So let's think about a river. You know, what is a river? Can you point to the thing that is the river? You can't take a bucket of water out of the river and say, that's the river. You can't even look at a particular place in the river and say, that's the river, because it's changing. I mean, it's like the water that's there now is gone in a second later. So it's, you know, it's different water all the time. The riverbed, maybe, we could talk about as being the river. But the riverbed without the water isn't much of a river. And if we think about the way rivers change, you know, in the course of their existence, a flood can change the course of that riverbed even. The riverbed is perhaps a little more stable than the water, but still that riverbed changes. It grows deeper. It changes course. What about the river's name? Well, that's clearly not the river. So there's some set of conditions that makes up that river. And we can all conventionally say, yes, that's the river. But there's no thing that is that river. That's what I'm trying to point to here. That river is a process. It's a flow of change. And we give it a name. We put a concept on it. And the concepts actually, I think, are a big place where this notion of permanence comes from, this notion of thingness comes from. That when we put a name on it and give it a sense of, yes, that's the river, it becomes a concept in our minds. And that concept creates a sense of stability, of yes, that's that thing. But what are concepts? They're just things, they're just kind of arising blips of neurons in our minds. They're not actually that stable either. There is something there that we call a river. It's not that it doesn't exist exactly, but it doesn't exist in the way that we think of as, okay, that is a thing, that is a river, that thing is there. So it doesn't exist in that way. But it also doesn't not exist. Another way to explore this sense of self is through the conditioned nature of experience. And this is a good analogy for this one is a rainbow. So if you think about what it takes for us to be able to see a rainbow, there needs to be the sun, and there needs to be water in the air, and there needs to be a viewer in a particular orientation with respect to the water and the sun. If any of those three pieces are not there, that rainbow doesn't exist. So it needs all three of those together. There's these conditions come together to create a rainbow. Now, this is perhaps even more obvious to us at you know, someplace like the ocean, you know, where there's sometimes at particular times of the day, there might be sprays of water that come up on rocks, and then the sun, and then the where we're standing, where we could see the creation of a rainbow for a split second, and then the water drops, and then so the rainbow disappears as soon as the water drops. But then the water comes back, and then the rainbow reappears. But if we weren't standing in that place, we wouldn't see a rainbow. If we were standing over a little farther, we might not see the rainbow. So it's these conditions that come together, these co-arising of conditions that create this appearance of the rainbow. So again, it's not that there's not something there. There's an experience being had. But it doesn't exist independent of these conditions coming together. So this is another way that the Buddha approached this topic. He said that typically we explore experience from the perspective of things exist or things don't exist. That's kind of an overlay, one of the views we have on experience, is that either it's something or it's nothing. But he says, this world, for the most part, depends upon a duality, upon the idea of existence and the idea of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of experience as it really is with correct wisdom, the idea of non-existence doesn't occur to one. And for one who sees the cessation of experience as it really is, there's the idea of existence does not occur to one. So then he goes on to talk about what is this experience? It's conditioned that with the arising of contact, there is sight. With the arising of sight, there's feeling. There's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling. With the arising of that, there's a sense of wanting to get rid of. With the arising of that, there's a sense of needing to have. A sense of, this is mine, this is me. That there's these conditions that come into play. And this whole sense of self, this whole process of identification, this process of what we think of as I or me, is simply a process of conditions unfolding. This is a teaching, a teaching called dependent origination, and I'm not going to go into the details of that. But basically, he's pointing to that the experience of self, what we experience itself as self, is a process that comes into being dependent on conditions. We fundamentally misunderstand it to be something, a thing. So I want to check in, see if there's any questions here first before I go on a little bit more. Yeah.
Reality, you are the outward expression of reality in this atmosphere that we're in right at the present time. We perceive that and we're aware of your presence, your reality. So,
but what you're aware of is...
It's what I perceive.
It's an experience. You're not perceiving actually... I mean, what you're experiencing is kind of a reflection of something.
Well, you're a person. You're a human being.
And what your experience of that is only a reflection.
But it's a reflection of my existence. I exist, and you.
I would say it's a reflection of a process.
Well, the process is that you're earth, water, fire, and air. That's all you are.
Uh-huh. And so consciousness.
You're aware of that, and you perceive that, uh-huh. and I perceive
uh-huh.
it.
Uh-huh.
So you might not exist a moment. But you exist now.
Yes. Well, but there's that question of what do we mean by existence?
That so well, you are the outward expression to my mindfulness of reality. You're real.
There is a form of reality there. Yes, that's what I was trying to say. That there's it's not that there's nothing there, but it doesn't exist in a kind of a stable, static way. It's a process.
Well, because you're constantly changing.
Yes.
You're constantly changing, even though I see you.
Yes.
We're all constantly changing.
Everything is constantly changing.
Yeah. For 80 years of our life, and then somebody else comes on the planet, and they exist. And they will be the outward expression of reality. So it's that's my reply to who I am and what I think, what I perceive.
So there is that sense of, I mean, the thing that I'm mostly pointing to is this sense of it's that there's process here rather than thing.
The process. Mm-hmm. The process of things are evolving. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm talking about it at a much more rapid level.
Much more what?
Rapid level
of change.
Yes, that when we actually start to turn to look at our experience, there's nothing that's stable even for a split second. It's just constantly coming and going.
Until I die, everything I see is got to be reality. It's got to be stable. But I am aware, I perceive that you're changing, but I still, as long as I can breathe my existence, I'm the only one alive. You know, if I close my eyes permanently, then.
So what I want to suggest, and what I think I'm going to go into more next week, is to keep looking at what it is that you think of as that existence. What is that that you think of as that existence? Explore that and get familiar with that.
Okay.
No, Tal has something to say.
Thought my understanding of how to hold this teaching is that it is not a viewpoint. It is not something to be argued one way or another. We can to say that I am a process is a view, to say that I am stable is a view. That the Buddha was interested in pointing us towards how we could be observing our reality in a way that would take us through our confusion to liberation. As we are with our experience moment to moment, we're seeing our experience, we're noticing things change, the ideas come and go. I have a thought. My thought, I have a sense of that thought being me, and then if I stay with it, it goes away. It doesn't seem like me. And everything that seems like it's me. And this is where it starts going into a viewpoint. But the Buddha was not saying that there is no self. The Buddha was saying, notice the way that that quality of identity comes and goes.
I know you're looking at me, you're speaking to me, but I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry, microphone. So noticing how we have the sense of identification with things, that sense of me. If there's a sense of something being me, just kind of noticing that there's a way that our experience has this kind of shifting and impersonal quality. Right. But there's no, it's not an opinion, it's not a viewpoint, it has nothing to do with opinions. Yeah.
The experience has nothing to do with opinions. What I'm talking about today are just ways of thinking about it to help you see the reality.
I think the way of thinking about it, thing of those, is where it gets dicey, because then it goes into the, all right, I mean, this is, seems like this is what, with Vajragadama, this is what the Buddha was like pointing. I mean, this is the sticky thing about the, it's an observation. I mean, maybe I have a, I don't know, does that, that whole like absence of taking a fixed perspective seems like an important aspect of it. And I almost have the sense sometimes people talk about like relative and absolute truth. I don't have a sense that that's what the Buddha was talking about in the canon, that there was actually pointing at like directly experience it. That's just my understanding.
Yeah, he is talking about directly experiencing it. And there are, I mean, we have to use conventional language to try to describe things.
Right, otherwise everything's silent.
That's not a bad thing. Any other comments or questions here? Yeah.
I think that there's a bit of a rhetorical boondoggle in putting that in a negative way.
Putting what in a negative?
Putting the idea of things being a process that, and the net effect of that implies that there is not a solid, permanent, reliable self. That when we look at it from the point of view, starting point of view of there is no self. First of all, we're using a really sort of vague word of self. You know, what are we talking about? You know, for me, myself as a process is plenty of self for me. I don't need any more self than that. It's like I really, you know, it's not really important to me whether or not myself goes any further than the walk across the room because I wouldn't be able to tell. You know, it's I could function, you know, a million different ways, so that doesn't matter. But when I seem to get this funny feeling when you start with, and it seems to be the traditional way of talking about it, of there is no self, my head does something funny with that information. But when the following information comes in, it's like, oh, that's fine, yeah.
The aspect of the process.
The process, yes. Is fine, sure. It obviously works. It's like I certainly do not have the same being that I had when I was in fourth grade. You know, it's like boo-boos that I had when I was a little kid. They are gone. You know, psychic ones, some of those are gone. You know, it's we're really, really fluxy. Our molecules, our thoughts, it's memories, it's like I can even see the little paths in my brain where I store things. If I travel too much, when I wake up in the morning, I don't know where I am. And I'll challenge myself, like, okay, where am I? And I'll try to feel by where the light, where I am. And that's the way our lives change.
So the thing the Buddha was pointing to also here is not so much about, you know, whether there's a self or not. I mean, it actually, as it's been pointed out many times, the only place in the Pali Canon where the Buddha was asked point blank, so is there no self, he refused to answer the question. but there's some conditions. There's some conditions around that fact. I mean, the Ananda came to him and said, "So why didn't you answer the question?" And he said, "Because it would have confused him." But the thing that he's really pointing to is where do we get stuck? What do we identify with? You know, that's what he's interested in, is where do we kind of cringe around things? It's like, you know, so yeah, just walking across the room, maybe, you know, you see yourself changing, but there's something that we get stuck to. What is it that we get stuck to? That's part of the interesting place, to look at that. What is it that we get stuck to? Do we get stuck to this sense of, I mean, yeah, there's a sense we all recognize, okay, yeah, I'm not the same person I was in fourth grade. Those injuries are gone, you know, so those problems are not anymore. But what are we carrying with us? What are we stuck to? What are we identified with? That's what we need to look at.
Happiness.
You're stuck to happiness. So let's hear some other things. What are people stuck to? You just call them out. I'll repeat them. Freedom.
Freedom and
happiness. Avoidance of pain.
Once you get rid of the non-self, then you're free. Once you walk through the non-self barrier, that you are nothing, then you are free because of your intelligence and your enlightenment. You can start communicating.
Anything else?
Connections,
relationships. So are these ways that we getting stuck?
Memory.
I think this is a big one, actually, that we get stuck, partly because we, memory serves to create this illusion of continuity.
You have to live in the present moment.
But we can't deny the fact that memory comes. I mean, but what memory is? I mean, what memory's illusion is that it somehow exists, independent of the present moment. But all it is just something arising in the present moment.
But you have to forget them and to be happy and just live in the present moment.
But they can arise and there not be a problem. It's what we need to see is that it is just an arising. It's just an arising in the present moment.
You're aware of it, and then you just let it go.
Yes.
You let it go. Then you're in the present moment again.
Well, you're in the you can just, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be, you can be in the present moment with the arising of a memory and see it. This is something that's arising right now. It can just be like the blooming of a flower. It's like, wow, look at that. A thought has arisen. And we can be right with that in the present moment. So it's not that because memories arise that we are not in the present moment. We can be present with memories arising in the present moment.
But for good memories, then you're fine. But for bad memories, you've got to let them go.
You have to see them for what they are. Yeah. Yeah.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. What this is making me think about in terms of, I think, what sometimes people attach to, when we're thinking about a memory that's unpleasant, I think sometimes people attach to fear around it.
So yes.
Can you hold it more this way so the people with the hearing system devices can?
Sure. So I was just saying that I think as this concept of memory is coming up, something that people attach to as an unpleasant memory arises is fear. Maybe going back to fear that comes up around that memory, or fear that bringing that memory into the current situation and being fearful that something's going to happen based on what happened in the past.
Yes, and so these things that we attach to, the fears, the relationships, the happiness, the avoidance of pain, all of them, they're all processes. They're all things happen. Yes, it's life happening. It's all life happening. Yeah. You got one in front of you.
to me, bring this back to the not self. And so when we're little, we start out not having any sense of separateness at all, not really having a sense of I at all, and then we gradually form that. We form and go through this process of ego formation and personality, and then we start having things happen to us. Our mom does something, our dad does something, and then we have we have this identification with those things, and then there in that there's this myself and another, and then this charge around it. This person hurt me, and there's a tremendous amount of our suffering that comes from that sense of I, this thing happened to me, myself over time that existed, that thing that happened before.
Well, the Buddha actually will go further than just say a tremendous amount of it. He'll say all. All of our suffering is rooted in that misunderstanding of there is me. There is a me here. And this, it's kind of like a concept. You know, that this me, this I, is a concept that's created in our minds. And then we believe it. You know, there's a theory in neuropsychology that I think is really interesting about kind of this formation of this notion of self. It comes from Antonio Damasio, and he talks about kind of the evolutionary perspective on how this notion of self came to be. And I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating that Western neuropsychology is coming up with this sense that what we call self is not what we think it is, that there is not this nothing abiding in there. And the evolution of this sense comes kind of from, you know, he looked at it in an evolutionary perspective, you know, the evolution of the nervous system. So starting with like single-celled creatures, there's a very direct relationship between the environment and the experience of going towards and pulling away in that single-cell creature. So you've got a single-cell creature, that there's food, it's going to naturally gravitate towards that. There's bad chemicals in the environment, it's going to pull away from that. It's not, you know, I think we can kind of have a sense that there's not necessarily, you know, a being in there making choices around this. It's kind of just the natural cause and effect around that creature's cellular system and what will support its continuing and what would make it dangerous. So there's this kind of, this kind of very direct contact with the environment. But then as the nervous systems got more developed, so, you know, we've got these limbs and these contact and all these feelers and sensors out at the edge of our system, but we're so distributed that the brain basically had to create a map of everything and in order to protect us. So, you know, so the similar kind of situation happens around there being something noxious in the environment. It's got to go all the way from the fingertips up into the brain to come to process with that map, you know, interact with that map and then go out and then make a decision, okay, pull the hand back or whatever. So, you know, the nervous system is distributed, but the processing becomes centralized into this brain, and the brain creates this map. And what I began to understand in reading this is that map, he called it the proto-self, actually, this map in our brains of our bodies, that's what the fastest way to defend and protect this being is to defend and protect the map. And that the map gets mistaken for the being.
The map is what we're consciously aware of.
The map is
consciousness aware.
I'm not sure I could say that. I don't know enough about how the map is defined.
We get it from our ancestors.
Yes, yes. It's part of our evolution that there is this map. And actually, I think they've determined that, like, the body is mapped out along the kind of cerebral cortex here, and they can even point to, okay, you know, here's the head, and, you know, kind of goes back, and there's the feet back there. So, you know, that what essentially the brain itself has been designed to protect this map. That's the fastest way this being can take care of itself, is to protect the map. And so the map kind of gets confused, conflated for the being itself. And to me, that's kind of like, oh, that kind of was an interesting understanding for me to begin to see how, you know, this whole sense of self-identification is very deeply ingrained in our biology in a way. But the Buddha discovered that this is not ingrained to the point of, I mean, we need this map to function, but we can also see it as a map. Let's see what time it is. We have 3 minutes. Let me just say a couple more things. One piece that I really wanted to point to this week is that we, having the view, having an idea that there is a sense of self, you know, this sense, this feeling of, yes, this is me, you know, I mean, it feels so intuitive that I'm here. You know, it's hard to kind of break through this notion of there not being something here. I mean, I can talk to myself about it, and I can experience things as a process, and I've experienced things in certain moments as just being, you know, just seeing things completely as process. And in those moments, it's very clear to me that there's no one here. But most of the time I'm walking around, and it sure feels like somebody's here, you know? That's the way it feels. So, you know, having that perspective, when we have that perspective, it's hard to not see things through that lens. So one of the things that I talked about this last week around views or perspectives like this is that when we have a view, it filters our perceptions so that we take in certain information and not other information. Or we may take in information, but it just doesn't like compute with our model. And so it's kind of like it somehow goes over to the side and we don't really acknowledge it as being something that counters what our model is. So there is evidence for not self in our experience. We know it every day. We see it every day. I mean, very simple things like the wandering mind. You know, if you're sitting down to meditate and you, yep, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to pay attention to my breath. And then the mind wanders. So who did that? How did that happen? I mean, did you choose to have that happen? I mean, if you were the one sitting to meditate, again, this points to the Buddha saying, you know, let my consciousness be thus. We can't do that. And even more amazing is the fact that our mind wakes up from wandering. You know, who did that? These moments of experience, they're there all the time. You know, they're there pointing out to us that things aren't the way we think they are. But we don't quite take it in as being evidence for not self. The general lack of control that we have over our experience, over our bodies, over our feelings, over perception, over our intentions. This is evidence also. So we can begin to start taking in, acknowledging our experiences when we can begin to see through, begin to have a different perspective on experience. We can begin to see things from a different perspective rather than from our kind of usual filters of experience. And now we need to stop. So I do want to continue this next week because I want to talk about exploring this, what we call self, because that's really where we can explore this. You know, what is it that we're calling self? What is it that we think of as self? And the one famous quote is, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. That the way to understand this teaching is not through having some idea or view that not self is true, but to begin to explore what it is that we think of as self and begin to see it's not what I thought it was. So we'll see you next week, I hope, some of you. Thank you.